he added with a sigh. "I had a father. He was a fine hunter," Kara told him proudly. "Even Jameson said so. But my father was taken by beasts," she explained.
"Aye, I heard that."
She could see that Matt was trying to look sad for her benefit, but it was difficult for a boy whose temperament was so merry. Already he was pointing at a butterfly, gleeful at the bright spotted orange of its wings in the dim forest light.
"See this? You brought it with my mother's things, remember?"
She lifted the rock pendant from the neck of her shift. Matt nodded.
"It be all purply and shiny-like."
Kira dropped it back gently inside her clothing. "My father made it as a gift from my mother." Matt wrinkled his face, thinking that over.
"Gift?"
he asked. Kira was startled that he didn't understand.
"When you care about someone and give them something special, something that they treasure, that's a gift."
Matt laughed.
"In the Fen they don't have that," he said. "In the Fen, if and they give you something special, it be a kick in your butty." "But that's a pretty thing you got," he added politely. "You be lucky I saved it."
It was a long journey for Kira, dragging her twisted leg. Her stick caught at roots knotted under the earth of the path, and she stumbled from time to time. But she was accustomed to the awkwardness and the ache. They had always been with her. Matt had run ahead with a branch, and they returned to her, excited, announcing that the destination was just around the next curve.
"A wee cot it is," he called. "And there's the crone outside in the garden, with her crookedy hands full of rainbow."
Kira hurried along, rounded the curve, and understood what he meant. In front of the tiny hut, a bent and white-haired old woman was working near a lush flower garden. She leaned toward a basket on the ground, lifted handfuls of bright-colored yarns, yellow of various shades, from the palest lemon to a deep tawny gold, and hung them across a rope that was strung from one tree to another. Deeper shades of rust and red were already hanging there. The woman's hands were gnarled and stained. She lifted one in greeting. She had few teeth, and her skin was folded into wrinkles, but her eyes were unclouded. She walked nearer to them, gripping a cane made of wood, and seeming unsurprised by the sudden visitors. She peered intently at Kira's face.
"You likin' your mum," she said.
"You know who I am?" Kira asked, puzzled.
The old woman nodded.
"My mother has died."
"Aye? I knowed it."
"How? How did you know?"
But Kira didn't ask.
"I'm called Kira. This is my friend. His name is Matt."
Matt stepped forward, suddenly a little shy.
"I brung my own crusty," he said. "Me and my doggie, we be no trouble to you."
"Sit," the woman named Annabella said to Kira, ignoring Matt and Branch, who was busily sniffing the garden, looking for the right place to lift his stubby leg.
"Doubtless you be weary and pained."
She gestured toward a low, flattened tree stump, and Kira sank down gratefully, rubbing her aching leg. She unlaced her sandals and emptied them of pebbles.
"You must learn the dyes," the old woman said. "You come for that, aye? Your mum did, and she was to teach you."
"There wasn't time," Kira sighed. "And now they want me to know it all, and do the work. The repairing of the singer's robe, you know about that?"
Annabella nodded. She returned to the drying rope and finished hanging the yellow strands.
"I can give you some threads," she said, "to start the repair. But you must learn the dyes. There are other things they'll want of you."
Kira thought again of the untouched expanse across the back and shoulders of the robe. It was what they would want of her, to fill that space with future.
"You must come here each day. You must learn all the plants. Look."
The woman gestured at the garden plot, thick with thriving plants, many in summer start bloom.
"Bedstraw," she said, pointing to a tall plant massed with golden blossoms. "The roots give good red. Matter's better for Reds, though. There's my matter over behind.
She pointed again, and Kira saw a sprawling, weedy plant in a raised bed.
"'Tis the wrong time to take the matter roots now. Fall starts better when it lies dormant.
Bedstraw, matter, I must remember these, I must know these.
Dyer's greenweed,
the woman announced, poking with her cane at a shrub with small flowers.
Use the shoots for a fine yellow. Don't move it, though, less than you must. Greenweed don't want a transplant.
Greenweed for yellow.
Kira followed the woman as she rounded a corner of the garden. Annabella stopped and poked at a clumped plant with stiff stems and small oval leaves.
Here's a tough fella, she said, almost affectionately. St. John's wort, he's called. No blooms yet, it's too early for him. But when he blooms, you can get a lovely brown from his blossoms. Stain your hands, though.
She held her own up and cackled with laughter. Then,
you'll be needing greens. Chamomile can give you that. Water it good, but take just the leaves for your green color. Save the blossoms for tea.
Kira's head was already spinning with the effort to remember the names of the plants and the colors they would create, and only a small corner of the lavish garden had been described. Now, at the sound of the word water, and also tea, she realized that she was thirsty.
"Please, do you have a well? Might I have a drink?" she asked.
"And Branchy, too? He been looking for a stream, but found naught."
Matt's voice piped beside Kira. She had almost forgotten that he was there. Annabella led them to her well behind the cot, and they drank gratefully. Matt poured water into the crevice of a curved rock for his dog, who lapped eagerly and waited for more. Finally, they sat together in the shade, Kira and the old woman, Annabella. Matt, gnawing his bread, wandered off with Branch at his heels.
"You must come each day," Annabella repeated. "You must learn all the plants, all the colors, as your mum did when she was a girl."
"I will. I promise."
"She said you had the knowledge in your fingers. More than she did."
Kira looked at her hands, folded in her lap.
"Something happens when I work with the threads. They seem to know things on their own, and my fingers simply follow."
Annabella nodded.
"That be the knowledge. I got it for the colors, but never for the threads. My hands was always too coarse."
She held them up, stained and misshapen.
"But to use the knowledge of the threading, you must learn the making of the shades. When to sadden with the iron pot. How to bloom the colors. How to bleed."
"To sadden, to bloom, to bleed? What a strange set of words."
"And the mordants, too. You must learn those. Sometimes sumac. Tree galls are good. Some lichens. Best is... Here, come. Let me show you. See you make a guess to its birthplace, this mordant."
With surprising agility for a woman of four-syllable age, Annabella rose and led Kira to a covered container near the place where a large kettle of dark water, too huge for cooking food, hung above the smoldering remains of an outdoor fire. Kira leaned forward to see, but when Annabella lifted the lid, she jerked her head back in unpleasant surprise. The smell of the liquid was terrible. Annabella laughed, a delighted cackle.
"Got you a guess?"
Kira shook her head. She couldn't imagine what was in the foul-smelling container or what its origin might be. Annabella replaced the lid, still laughing.
"You save it and age it good," she said. "Then it brings the hue to life and sets it firm." "It's old piss," she explained with a satisfied chuckle.
Late in the day, Kira set out for home with Matt and Branch. The bag she carried over her shoulder was filled with colored threads and yarns that Annabella had given to her.
"These'll do for you now," the old dyer had said. "But you must learn to make your own. Say back to me now those you keep in mind."
Kira closed her eyes, thought, and said them aloud. "Madder for red, bedstraw for red too, just the roots, tops of tansy for yellow, and greenwood for yellow too, and yarrow, yellow and gold, dark hollyhocks, just the petals, for mauve."
"Snotweed,"
Matt said loudly with a grin and wiped his own runny nose on his dirty sleeve.
"Hush, you," Kira said to him, laughing. "Don't play foolish now. It's important I remember."
"Broom sedge," she added, still remembering. "Goldy yellows and browns. And St. John's wort for browns, too, but it'll stain my hands. And bronze fennel, leaves and flowers. Use them fresh, and you can eat it, too. Chamomile for tea and for green hues."
"That's all I remember now," Kira said apologetically. There had been so many others.
Annabella nodded in approval.
"It's a starting," she said.
"Matt and I must go, or it will become dark before we're back," Kira said, turning.
Looking at the sky to assess the time, she suddenly remembered something.
"Can you make blue?" she asked.
But Annabella frowned.
"You need the woad," she said. "Gather fresh leaves from first year's growth of woad. And soft rainwater. That makes the blue."
She shook her head.
"I have not. Others do, but they be far away."
"Who be others?" Matt asked.
The old woman didn't answer the boy. She pointed toward the far edge of her garden, where the woods began, and there seemed to be a narrow, overgrown path. Then she turned toward her hut. Kira heard her speak in a low voice.
"I ne'er could make it," she was saying. "But some have blue yonder."
Chapter 9. The singer's robe contained only a few tiny spots of ancient blue, faded almost to white. After her supper, after the oil lamps had been lit, Kira examined it carefully. She lay her threads, the ones from her own small collection and the many others that Annabella had given to her, on the large table, knowing she would have to match the hues carefully in daylight before she began the repairs. It was then that she noticed, with relief because she would not know how to repair it, and with disappointment because the color of sky would have been such a beautiful addition to the pattern, that there was no real blue anymore, only a hint that there once had been. She said the names of the plants over and over aloud, trying to make a chant of them for easier memory.
"Hollyhock and tansy, madder and bedstraw."
But they fell into no comfortable rhythm and did not rhyme. Thomas knocked at her door. Kira greeted him happily, showed him the robe and threads, and told him of her day with the old dyer.
"I can't remember all the names," she said in frustration. "But I'm thinking that if in the morning I go back to where my old cot was, maybe my mother's garden plants, the ones she used for colors, will still be there. And then, seeing them, the names will mean more. I only hope Vandara..."
She paused. She had not told the carver about her enemy, and even saying the name made her apprehensive. "The woman with the scar?" Thomas asked. Kira nodded.
"Do you know her?"
He shook his head.
"But I know who she is," he said. "Everyone does."
He picked up a little skein of the deep crimson. "How did the dyer make this?" he asked curiously. Kira thought.
"Madder for red."
"Madder," she recalled. "Just the roots."
"Madder," he repeated.
Then an idea occurred to him. "I could write the names for you, Kira," he suggested. "It would make the remembering easier."
"You can write and read?"
Thomas nodded. I learned when I was young. Boys can, the ones who are chosen. And some of the carving I do has words.
But I can't. So even if you were to write the names, I couldn't read them. And it's not permitted for girls to learn.
Still, I could help you in the remembering. If you told them to me and I wrote them, then I could read them to you. I know it would help.
She realized he was probably right. So he brought pen and ink and paper from his quarters, and once again she said the words, those she could recall. In the flickering light, she watched as he carefully wrote them down. She saw how the curves and lines and combinations made the sounds, and that he was then able to say them back to her. When he read the word hollyhock aloud with his finger on the word, she saw that it was long, with many lines like tall stems. She turned her eyes away quickly so that she would not learn it, would not be guilty of something clearly forbidden to her. But it made her smile to see it, to see how the pen formed the shapes, and the shapes told a story of a name. Very early in the morning, Kira ate quickly and then walked to the place where her mother's color garden had been. Few people were up and about yet at sunrise. She half expected to encounter Matt and Branch, but the paths were mostly empty and the village was still quiet. Here and there a tyke cried, and she could hear the soft clucking of chickens, but the noisy clangor of daytime life was yet to come. Approaching, she could see the pen that was already partly built. It had been only a few days, but the women had gathered thorn bushes and circled them around the remains of the cot where Kira had grown up. The encircled ground was still ashes and rubble. Very soon the thorned fence they were building would enclose the area completely. She supposed they would create some kind of gate, and then they would shove their chickens and their tykes inside. There would be sharp wood pieces and jagged fragments of broken pots. Kira sighed, seeing it. The tykes would be scratched and splintered by scraps of her own destroyed past, but there was nothing she could do. She edged quickly past the wreckage and the half-built fence and found the remains of her mother's color garden at the edge of the woods. The vegetable garden was completely stripped, but the flower plot remained, though its plants were trampled. Clearly the women, dragging their bushes to build the pen, had simply walked across the area, yet the blossoms continued to bloom, and she was awed to see that vibrant life still struggled to thrive despite such destruction. She named them to herself, those she remembered, and picked what she could, filling the cloth she had brought. Annabella had told her that most of the flowers and leaves could be dried and used later. Some, like bronze fennel, should not.
"Use it fresh," Annabella had said of the fennel. "You could eat it, too."
Kira left it where it grew, and wondered if the women would know that it could be harvested for food. A dog barked nearby, and now she could hear arguing, a hubby shouting at his wife, a tyke being slapped. The village was waking to its routine. It was time for her to go. This was not her place anymore. Kira gathered the cloth around the plants she had collected and tied the edges together. Then she slung it over her shoulder, picked up her walking stick, and hurried away. On a back path, avoiding the central lane of the village, Kira saw Vandara and averted her eyes. The woman called her name in a smug, taunting voice.
"Liking your new life?" she called, and followed the question with a harsh laugh.
Quickly, Kira turned a corner to escape a confrontation, but the memory of the sarcastic question and the woman's smirk accompanied her home. "I'll need a place to grow a color garden," she told Jameson hesitantly a few days later, "and an airy place for drying the plants, also a place where a fire can be built, and pots for the dying." She thought some more, then added, "And water." He nodded and said that such things could be provided. He came each evening to her quarters to assess her work and to ask her needs. It seemed strange to Kira that she could make requests and to have them answered. But Thomas said it had always been so for him, too. The kinds of wood, ash, heartwood, walnut, or curly maple, each had been brought when he asked, and they had given him tools of all sorts, some he had not known of before. The days, busy ones, tiring ones, began to pass. One morning, as Kira prepared to go to the dyer's hut, Thomas came to her room. "Did you hear anything last night?" he asked her uncertainly. "Maybe a sound that woke you?" Kira thought. "No," she told him. "I slept soundly. Why?" He seemed puzzled, as if he were trying to remember something.
"I thought I heard something, a sound, like a child crying. I thought it woke me, but maybe it was a dream. Yes, I guess it was a dream."
He brightened and shrugged off the little mystery.
"I've made something for you," he told her. "I've been doing it in the early mornings," he explained, "before I started my regular work."
"What is your usual work, Thomas?" Kira asked. "Mine's the robe, of course, but what have they set you to do?"
"The singer's staff. It's very old. And his hands, and the hands of other singers in the past, I suppose, have worn the carvings down so it must all be recarved. It's difficult work, but important. The singer uses the carvings of the staff to find his place, to remind him of the sections in the song. And there's a large place at the top that has never been carved. Eventually I'll be doing that, carving it for the first time, making my own designs." He laughed. "Not my own, really. They'll tell me what to put there." "Here."
Shyly, Thomas reached into his pocket and handed her the gift. He had made her a small box with a tight-fitting lid, its top and sides intricately carved in the pattern of the plants she was beginning to learn and to know. She examined it with delight. She recognized the tall spikes of yarrow and its dense clustered blossoms. Around them twined the flopping stems of coreopsis, above a carved base of that plant's mounted dark and feathery leaves. She knew instantly what she wanted to place in the exquisite box, the small scrap of decorated cloth that she had carried in her pocket on the day of the trial, and that comforted her loneliness when she held it before sleeping, was hidden away in one of the drawers that contained supplies. She no longer carried it with her because she feared losing it during her long walks through the woods and her long days hard at work with the dyer. Now, with Thomas watching, she fetched the scrap and laid it in the box.
"It's a lovely thing," he said, seeing the small cloth.
Kira stroked it before she closed the lid. "It speaks to me somehow," she told him. "It seems almost to have life."
She smiled, embarrassed, because she knew it was an odd thing and that he would not understand and could perhaps find her foolish.
But Thomas nodded.
"Yes," he said, to her surprise. "I have a piece of wood that does the same. One I carved long ago when I was just a tyke. And sometimes I feel it in my fingers still, the knowledge that I had then."
He turned to leave. "That you had then? No more? The knowledge doesn't stay?"
Kira was dismayed at the thought, but she said nothing to her friend. Though there was still so much information she needed to acquire from Annabella, Kira was forced to make her learning time at the dyer's cot shorter, because it was important to begin to work on the singer's robe and she needed the daylight. She was glad now of the tiled bathroom that had caused her such confusion at first. The warm water and soap helped to rid her hands of stains, and it was vital that her hands be clean when she touched the robe. She still had her small frame, the one that Matt had saved from the fire, but there was no need of it. Among the supplies provided for her was a fine new frame that unfolded and stood on sturdy wooden legs so that it was not necessary to hold it in her lap. She placed the frame by the window so she could sit in a chair beside it while she worked. She spread out the robe on the large table to examine it carefully and select the place where she should begin her work. Now, for the first time, Kira began to perceive the vastness from which the singer created his song. The entire history of the people, culminating with the horrifying story of the ruin,
was portrayed with immense complexity on the voluminous folds of the robe. Kira could see pale green sea, and in its depths fish of all kinds, some larger than men, larger than 10 men together. Then the sea blended imperceptibly into sweeping areas of land, populated only by the figures of animal life unknown to her, hulking creatures grazing on tall, tan grasses. All of this was only one small corner of the singer's robe. As her eyes moved along, she saw that out of the pale sea, near the grazing land, rose other land, and on this land appeared men. The tiny stitches created figures of hunters with spears and weaponry, and she saw that little knots of red, matter for red, just the roots, had been used to color blood on the figures of fallen men, those taken by beasts. She thought of her father. But this scene was long ago, long before her father, long before any of their people. The lifeless men dotted with the red knots of blood were still an infinitesimal section of the robe, a blink of an eye, forgotten now except for the once-a-year song, the time that the singer reminded them of the past. Looking at the robe and smoothing it with her washed hand, Kira sighed and realized that she did not have time for such study. There was important work to be done, and she had noticed Jameson's increasing sense of urgency. Again and again he came to her room, checking, making certain that she was attentive to her job and would be meticulous in the work. Identifying a place on one sleeve that badly needed repair, Kira moved that section of the robe into the frame, which held it taut. Then, carefully, using the delicate cutting tools she had been given, Kira snipped away the frayed threads. There was a small stain across an intricately threaded flower in shades of gold, part of a landscape that portrayed rows of tall sunflowers near a pale green stream. Someone long ago, someone skilled in the art, had made the stream appear to flow by stitching white curving lines that gave a sense of foam. How gifted the earlier threader had been! But those stained threads would need to be replaced. The work was painstakingly slow. Her mother, though her fingers had not had the almost magical knowledge that Kira's had, would have been more experienced, more deft, and faster. She held the new gold threads to the window and examined the subtle shifts in hue, choosing just the right ones for the repair. When the late afternoon light began to dim, Kira stopped work. She looked at the few inches in the frame, assessing what she had accomplished, and decided that she was doing well. Her mother would have been pleased. Jameson would be pleased. She hoped that when the time came to don the robe, the singer would be satisfied as well. But her fingers ached. Kira rubbed them and sighed. This was not at all the same as her own threadings, the small pieces she had done throughout her childhood. It was certainly not like the special one that had begun to move of its own volition in her hand beside her mother's deathbed, to twist and mix the threads in ways she had never learned, to form patterns she had never seen. Her hands had never tired then. Thinking of that special scrap, Kira went to the carved box, unfolded the bit of cloth, and put it in her pocket. It felt familiar and welcome there, as if a friend had come to visit. It was almost time for her evening meal to be brought. Kira covered the spread-out robe with a plain cloth to protect it. Then she went along the corridor and knocked on Thomas's door. The young carver was also just finishing his work. When he called, "Come in," Kira entered and saw that he was wiping the blades of his tools and putting them away. The long staff lay across his work table, held in a clamp. He smiled when he saw her. They had begun to eat their evening meal together each night. "Listen," Thomas said, and pointed to his windows. She could hear noise coming from the central plaza below. Her own room, facing the forest, was always quiet.
"What's happening?"
"Take a look. They're preparing for a hunt tomorrow." Kira moved to the window and looked down. Below, the men were gathering for the distribution of weapons. Hunts always began early in the morning. The men left the village before sunrise, but this was preparation. Kira could see that the doors had been opened in an outbuilding beside the council edifice, and from the storage place long spears were being brought and placed in piles in the center of the plaza. Men were lifting the spears, testing the weight, looking for the one that felt right. There were arguments. She saw two men with their hands grasping the same spear shaft, each determined to hold on. They were yelling at each other. In the midst of the noisy chaos, Kira saw a small figure dart in among the men and grab a spear. No one else seemed to notice. They were all absorbed with themselves, shoving and pushing. She saw that one man was already bloodied from a spear point, and it was clear that others would be injured before the disorganized distribution was complete. No one paid any attention to the boy. From her place in the window, Kira watched as the figure, holding an undisputed spear, moved triumphantly to the side of the crowd. A dog scampered by his bare feet.
"It's Matt!" Kira cried in dismay. "He's just a tyke, Thomas. He's much too young for a hunt."
When Thomas came to the window, she pointed. He followed her finger and finally saw Matt where he stood to the side with his spear. Thomas chuckled. "Sometimes boy tykes do that," he explained. "The men don't care. They let them follow along on the hunt."
"But it's too dangerous for a tyke, Thomas."
"What do you care?" Thomas seemed genuinely curious. "They're only tykes. There are too many of them anyway."
"He's my friend."
He seemed to comprehend then. She saw his face change. He looked down toward the boy with concern. Kira could see that now Matt was encircled by the pack of mischief-makers who were often at his side. They were admiring him as he brandished the spear. Kira felt a startling sensation, a throbbing in her hip. She reached for it, intending to rub it away, thinking that perhaps she had leaned too hard against the windowsill. Then her hand went instinctively to her pocket. She remembered that she had placed the scrap of cloth there. She touched the fabric and felt tension, danger, and a warning from it.
"Please, Thomas," Kira said urgently, "help me stop him."
Chapter 10. It was difficult to get through the crowd. Kira followed Thomas, who was taller than she, as he pushed to make a path through the shouting, raucous men. She recognized some. The butcher was there, cursing as he argued with another man, and she could see her mother's brother, too, in a group comparing the weights of their weapons with loud, bragging comments. Kira had not been much in the world of men. They led very separate lives from those of women. She had never envied them. Now, as she found herself jostled by their thick, sweat-smelling bodies, as she heard their muttered angry comments and their shouts, she found herself both frightened and annoyed. But she realized that this was hunt behavior, a time for flaunting and boasting, a time for testing each other. No wonder Matt, with his childish swagger, wanted to be part of it. A light-haired man with blood smeared on his arm turned from a shoving match and grabbed at her as she hurried by.
"Here's a trophy," she heard him call out.
But his companions were preoccupied with their argument. Using her walking stick as a prod, she pushed the man away and wrenched her wrist free from his grasp.
"You shouldn't be here," Thomas whispered when she caught up with him.
They had almost reached the side of the square where they had last spotted Matt.
"It's always only men, and at hunt time they act brutish."
Kira knew that. She could tell from the smell, the coarse quarreling, and the noise that it was not a place for girls or women, and she kept her head lowered and her eyes on the ground, hoping not to be noticed and grabbed again.
"There's Branch!"
She pointed at the little dog, who recognized her and wagged his crooked stub of a tail.
"Matt will be nearby."
With Thomas beside her, she pushed her way through and found him, still prancing with his spear. Its sharp point was dangerously close to the other tyke's.
"Matt!"
she called in a scolding voice. He saw her, waved, and grinned.
"I'm Matty now," he called.
Exasperated, Kira grabbed the spear shaft just above his hand.
You won't be two syllables for a long time, Matt, she said. Thomas, take this.
She removed the spear from Matt's grasp and handed it carefully to the carver.
Yes, I be, Matt said, laughing and proud. Looky here, I've got me a manly pelt.
The little boy raised both arms above his head to show her his joke. Kira looked. His underarms were thick with some kind of growth.
What is that?
She asked him. Then she wrinkled her nose.
It smells terrible.
She touched it, pulled some away, and began to laugh.
Matt, that's swamp grass. It's awful stuff. What do you mean, plastering yourself with it?
She could see that he'd smeared it on his chest as well.
Thomas handed the spear to a man, who grabbed it eagerly. He looked down at Matt, who was wiggling under Kira's hands on his shoulders.
You look like a beast, boy. What do you say, Kira? I think it's time we showed Matt the bathroom. Shall we clean him up and wash his second syllable away?
At the word wash, Matt wiggled harder, trying to get free. But Thomas and Kira both held him, and finally he allowed Thomas to pick him up and carry him on his shoulders, towering over the crowd. Now that the dangerous fascination of the spear was gone, Matt's group of young admirers dispersed. Kira could hear Matt calling from his perch above the noisy, shoving men.
"Looky here at the beast boy!"
No one looked or cared. She found Branch underfoot and picked him up to carry him safe from so many trampling feet. Carrying the dog tucked under her free arm, Kira leaned on her stick and followed Thomas. They edged their way around the crowd and back into the quiet of the building's corridors. Kira listened, laughing, to the wails and whimpers as Thomas mercilessly scrubbed both Matt and Branch in his bathroom tub.
"Not me hairs, too,"
Matt howled in protest as Thomas poured water over his tangled mop of hair.
"You're drowning me."
Finally, with Matt pink-faced and subdued, his washed hair toweled into a halo and his clean body wrapped in a blanket, they shared their meal. Branch shook himself briskly as if he had just played in the stream, then settled himself on the floor and nibbled at scraps they handed to him. Matt sniffed warily at his own hand and grimaced.
"That soapy's horrid awful," he said. "But I like the food," he added, and filled his plate again.
After dinner, Kira brushed his hair while he complained loudly. Then she held a mirror for him. Mirrors had been new to her, too, when she came here to live, and they gave an image different from the stream reflection that had been all she had known of herself. Matt examined his own image with interest, wrinkling his nose and raising his eyebrows. He showed his teeth, growled at the mirror, and startled Branch, who was sleeping under the table.
"I be so fierce," Matt announced smugly. "You would have drowned me, but I fought so fierce."
Finally, they redressed him in his raggedy clothing. He looked down at himself. Then he reached suddenly for the leather thong around Kira's neck.
"Gimme," he said.
She pulled back, annoyed.
"Don't, Matt," she told him, and pulled her necklace loose from his hand. "Don't grab. If you want something, you should ask."
"Gimme is an ask," he pointed out, puzzled.
"No, it isn't. You should learn some manners."
"Anyway," Kira added, "you can't have it. I told you, it was special."
"A gift," Matt said.
"Yes, a gift from my father to my mother."
"So she'd like him best."
Kira laughed. "Maybe so, but she already liked him best."
"I want a gift. I never be having one."
Laughing, Thomas and Kira gave him the smooth bar of soap, which he tucked solemnly into his pocket. Then they turned him loose. By now, the men and the spears were gone. They watched from the window as the small figure, followed by his dog, crossed the deserted plaza and disappeared into the night. Alone with Thomas, Kira tried to explain the warning that had come to her from the cloth.
"It creates a feeling in my hand," she explained hesitantly. "Look."
She took it from her pocket and held it toward the light. But it was still now. She could feel a kind of comfort and silence from it, nothing like the tension that had stirred it earlier. But she felt disappointed that it now seemed no more than a scrap of cloth. She wanted Thomas to understand. She sighed.
"I'm sorry," she said. "It seems lifeless, I know, but there are times..."
Thomas nodded. "Perhaps the feeling is for you alone," he said. "Here, I'll show you my bit of wood." He went to a shelf above the table where he kept his tools and took down a piece of light-colored pine, small enough to fit into the palm of his hand. Kira could see that it was intricately decorated with carved designs that interwove around it in complicated curves.
"You carved this when you were just a tyke?" she asked him in surprise.
She had never seen anything so extraordinary. The boxes and ornaments that were on his work table, beautiful in their own way, were much simpler than this small piece. Thomas shook his head. "I began to," he explained. "I was learning to use the tools. I began to try them on this small chunk of wood that had been discarded, and it..." He hesitated. He stared at the piece of wood as if it mystified him still.
"It carved itself?" Kira asked.
"It did. It seemed to, at least."
"It was the same for me with the cloth."
"That's why I understand the way the cloth speaks to you. The wood speaks in the same way. I can feel it in my hand. Sometimes it..."
"Warns you?"
Kira asked, remembering how the cloth had seemed to tense and tremble when she saw Matt holding the spear. Thomas nodded. "And calms me," he added. "When I came here so young, sometimes I was very lonely and frightened, but the feel of the wood was calming."
"Yes, the cloth is soothing at times, too. I was fearful here at first, the same as you, when everything was so new. But when I held the scrap, I felt reassured."
She thought for a moment, trying to picture what this life in the edifice must have been like for Thomas, brought here very young.
"I think it's easier for me because I'm not alone, as you were," she told him. "Jameson comes every day to look at my work, and I have you just down the corridor."
The two friends sat silently for a moment. Then Kira replaced the cloth in her pocket and rose from her chair.
"I must go to my room," she said. "There's so much to do."
"Thank you for helping me with Matt," she added.
"He's a naughty tyke, isn't he?"
Thomas, returning his carved piece to the shelf, agreed with a grin.
"Horrid naughty," he said, and they laughed together with affection for their little friend.
Chapter 11 Kira, trembling, hurried into the clearing where Annabella's small house stood. She was alone this morning. Matt still accompanied her occasionally, but he was bored by the old dyer and her endless instructions. More often, he and his dog were off with his friends, dreaming up adventures. Matt was still annoyed about the bath. His mates had laughed at him when they saw him clean. So this morning, Kira made her own way down the forest path. This morning, for the first time, she had been frightened.
"What's wrong?"
Annabella was at the outdoor fire. She must have risen before dawn to have the fire so hot by now. It crackled and spat under the huge iron kettle. Yet the sun had barely risen when Kira set out. Catching her breath, Kira limped past the gardens to where the old woman stood sweating as the heat from the flames pulsed and shimmered in the air. There was an aura of safety here, Kira felt. She willed her body to relax.
"You have a fear look to you,"
the dyer observed.
"A beast followed me on the path," Kira explained, trying to breathe normally.
The panic was beginning to subside, but she still felt tense.
"I could hear it in the bushes. I could hear its steps, and sometimes it growled."
To her surprise, Annabella chuckled. The old woman had always been kind to her and patient. Why would she laugh at her fear?
"I can't run," Kira explained. Because of my leg.
No need of running, Annabella said. She stirred the water in the pot, which was beginning to show occasional small bubbles at the surface.
We'll boil coneflowers for a brownish green, she said. Just the flower heads. The leaves and stems make gold.
With a nod of her head, she indicated a filled sack of flower heads on the ground nearby. Kira picked up the sack. When Annabella, testing the water with her stick, nodded, she emptied the massed blossoms into the pot. Together they watched as the mixture began to simmer. Then Annabella laid her stirring stick on the ground.
Come inside, the old woman said. I'll give you tea for calming.
From a nearby, smaller fire, she lifted a kettle from its hook and carried it into the cot. Kira followed her. She knew the flowerheads would have to boil till midday and then remain steeping in their water for many hours more. Extracting the colors was always a slow process. The coneflower dye water would not be ready for use until the next morning. The dyeing yard, affected by the fire, was already sultry and almost oppressive. But inside, the cot was cool, protected by its thick walls. Dried plants, beige and fragile, hung from the ceiling rafters. On a thick wooden table by the window, piles of colored yarns lay ready for sorting. It was part of Kira's learning to name and sort the threads. She went to her place at the sorting table, set her stick against the wall, and sat down. Behind her, Annabella poured water from the kettle over dried leaves that she had placed in two thick mugs.
This deep brown is from the goldenrod shoots, isn't it?
Kira held the strands to the window light.
It looks lighter than when it was wet, but it's still a fine brown.
She had helped the dyer prepare the shoots for their dye bath a few days before. Annabella brought the mugs to the table. She glanced at the strands in Kira's hand and nodded.
The goldenrod be blossoming soon. We'll use the blossoms fresh, not dried, for brightest yellow. And the blossoms boil only a short time, not as long as the shoots.
More bits of knowledge to grasp and hold in her memory. She would ask Thomas to write them down with the rest. Kira sipped at the strong hot tea and thought again about the ominous stalking sound in the woods.
I was so frightened on my way here, she confessed. Truly, Annabella, I can't run at all. My leg's a useless thing.
She looked down at it, ashamed. The old woman shrugged.
It brung you here, she said.
Yes, and I'm grateful for that, but I move so slowly.
Kira stroked the rough side of the earthen mug, thinking.
When Matt and Branch come with me, nothing stalks me. Maybe Matt would let me bring Branch each day. Even a little dog might scare the beasts back.
Annabella laughed.
There be no beasts, she said.
Kira stared at her. Of course, no beasts would come to this clearing where fires glowed, and the old woman seemed never to leave the clearing, never to walk the path to the village.
All I need be here, she had told Kira, speaking disdainfully of the village and its noisy life.
But still, she had lived to be four syllables and had acquired four generations of wisdom. Why did she suddenly sound like an ignorant tyke, pretending that there was no danger? Like Matt, beating his chest with bravado and pasting it thick with swamp grass that he called a manly pelt. Pretending didn't keep you safe.
I heard it growl, Kira said in a low voice.
Name the threads, Annabella commanded.
Kira sighed. Yarrow, she said, and set some pale yellow next to the deep brown. The dyer nodded. She examined a brighter yellow in the light.
Tansy,
she decided finally, and the dyer nodded again.
It growled, Kira said once more.
There be no beasts, the dyer repeated firmly.
Kira continued to sort and name the threads.
Matter,
she said, stroking the deep red, one of her favorites. She picked up a pale lavender near it and frowned. I don't know this one. It's pretty.
Elderberry, the old woman told her. But it don't stay fast. It don't linger.
Kira folded the lavender threads in her hand. Annabella, she said finally. It growled. It did.
Then it be human, playing at beast, Annabella told her in a firm and certain voice, meaning to keep you scared of the woods. There be no beasts.
Together, slowly, they sorted and named the threads. Later, walking home through a silent forest with no frightening sounds from the thick bushes on either side of the path, Kira wondered what human would have stalked her, and why. Thomas, Kira asked as they ate together, have you ever seen a beast?
Not alive.
You've seen a dead one, then?
We all have, when the hunters bring them in. The other night, remember, they brought them in after the hunt. There was a huge pile over by the butcher's yard.
Kira wrinkled her nose, remembering. What a smell, she said. But Thomas... He waited for her question. Tonight for dinner they had been brought meat in a thick sauce. Beside it on the plate were some small roasted potatoes. Kira pointed at the meat on her own plate. This is what the hunters brought. It's hare, I think. He nodded, agreeing. Everything the hunters brought in was like this. Wild rabbit, some birds. There wasn't anything, well, anything very large.
There were deer. I saw two at the butcher's.
But deer are gentle, frightened things. The hunters bring nothing with claws or fangs. They never catch anything that could be called a beast.
Thomas shuddered. Lucky. A beast could kill.
Kira thought of her father, taken by beasts. Annabella says there be none, she confided.
Be none?
Thomas looked puzzled. That's the way she said it. There be no beasts.
She speaks like Matt?
Thomas had not met the old dyer. Kira nodded. A bit. Perhaps she grew up in the fen. They ate in silence for a moment. Finally, Kira asked again. So you've never seen a real beast?
No,
Thomas acknowledged. But probably you know someone who has. He thought for a moment and then shook his head.
Do you?
He asked. Kira looked at the table. It had always been hard to talk of it, even to her mother. My father was taken by beasts, she told him.
You saw it?
His voice was shocked. No, I was not yet born.
Your mother saw?
She tried to remember her mother's telling. No, she didn't. He went on the hunt. Everyone says that he was a fine hunter. But he didn't return. They came to my mother with the news that he'd been attacked and taken by beasts on the hunt. She looked at him, puzzled. Yet Annabella says there be none.
How could she know? Thomas asked, skeptically.
She's four syllables, Thomas. Those who live to four syllables know all there is. Thomas nodded in agreement, then yawned. He had been working hard all day. His tools still lay on the work table, small chisels with which he had been meticulously recarving, reshaping the worn, smooth places on the elaborate staff that the singer used. It was painstaking work that allowed for no error. Thomas had told her that often his head ached and he had to stop again and again to rest his eyes. I'll go so you can rest, Kira told him. I must put away my own work before bed. She returned to her room at the other end of the corridor and folded the robe that still lay on her table. She had worked on the stitchery throughout the afternoon, after her return from the forest. She had shown it to Jameson as she did each day, and he had nodded in approval. Now Kira was tired, too. The long walks to the dyer's cot each day were exhausting, but at the same time the fresh air made her feel cleansed and invigorated. Thomas should get outside more, she thought, and then laughed to herself. She sounded like a scolding mother. After a bath, how she enjoyed the warm water now, Kira put on the simple nightgown that was provided clean for her each day. Then she went to the carved box and took the scrap of fabric with her to her bed. The fear of the thing in the bushes by the path lingered with her still, and she thought of it as she waited for sleep. Is it true that there be no beasts? Her thoughts framed the question, and her mind responded in a whisper to herself as the fabric lay curled warm in the palm of her hand. There be none. What of my father, then? Him taken by beasts. Kira drifted into sleep, the words gliding slippery from her thoughts. She dreamed the question, her breath soft and even against the pillow. The fabric gave a kind of answer, but it was no more than a flutter, like a breeze across her that she would not remember when she woke at dawn. The scrap told her something of her father, something important, something that mattered. But the knowledge entered her sleep, trembling through like a dream, and in the morning she did not know that it was there at all. Chapter 12. When the bell for rising rang, Kira awoke with a sense that something had changed. She had an awareness of a difference, but had forgotten what the difference was. She sat for a moment on the edge of her bed, thinking. But she could not grasp whatever it was, and finally stopped trying. Sometimes, she knew, lost memories and forgotten dreams came back more easily if you put them out of your mind. Outside, it was stormy. Wind shook the trees and blew a sheet of heavy rain against the building. The hard ground below had turned to mud overnight, and it was clear that Kira would not go to the dyer's cot today. Just as well, she thought. There was much work to do on the robe, and autumn start, the time of the gathering, was approaching. Recently, Jameson had been stopping by sometimes twice a day to see the progress she had made. He seemed pleased by her work. "Here," he had said to her just the day before yesterday, smoothing his hand across the large, undecorated place, "is where you will start your own work. After this year's gathering, after you've finished with the restoration, you'll have this entire section to work on for years to come." Kira touched the place where his hand lay. She tried to determine whether her fingers would feel the magic there, but there was only emptiness. There was a feeling of unfilled need. He seemed to sense her uncertainty and reassured her. "Don't worry," he said. "We will explain to you what we want pictured there." Kira didn't reply. His reassurance troubled her. It wouldn't be instruction that she needed. It would be the magic to come to her hands. Remembering the conversation, Kira thought suddenly, "Jameson, I can ask him about the beasts." He had told her that he had been part of the hunt that day, that he had seen her father's death. And maybe she would ask Matt, too. Wild little thing that he was, Kira had no doubt that Matt had crossed the boundaries often and had gone to places tykes were not supposed to go. She laughed quietly, thinking of Matt and his mischief. He spied on everything, knew everything. Had she and Thomas not stopped him, he would have tagged along with the men on the hunt and put himself in danger. Perhaps he had done it before. Perhaps he had seen beasts. When the tender came with the morning meal, Kira asked that the lights be lit. The rainstorm made the room dim, even beside the window where she sat to work. Finally, she settled herself with the outspread robe and placed the frame around the newest section waiting to be repaired. As she had often done, she followed with her eyes and fingers the complex story of the world portrayed on the robe. The starting point, long mended now, with the green water, the dark beasts on its shore, and the men bloodied by the hunt. Beyond, villages appeared with dwellings of all kinds. Curving stitches of smoke from fires were threaded with dull purplish grays. It was fortunate that it needed no repair, because Kira had no threads to match. She thought they had been dyed with basil, and Annabella had told her how difficult the basil was, and how badly it stained your hands. Then complex, whirling patches of fire, oranges, reds, yellows. Here and there on the robe these fires appeared, a repetitive